This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 266 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn read-along. If you've been listening to our show, you've heard us talk about Framebridge. They make it super easy and affordable to frame your favorite things, from art prints and posters to the travel photos sitting on your phone. And here's how it works. Just go to framebridge.com and upload your photo, or they'll send you packaging to safely mail in your physical pieces.
Preview your item online in any frame style. Choose your favorite or get a free recommendation from their talented designers. The expert team at Framebridge will custom frame your item and deliver your finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang.
Instead of the hundreds you'd pay at a framing store, their prices start at $39 and all shipping is free. Plus, our listeners will get 15% off their first order at framebridge.com when they use our code Outlander. Now, Summer and I have each, or together, really, we've had the opportunity to take advantage of a Framebridge offer, and we each got a frame, and we used that when on pictures that we got in Scotland during our pod abroad in May of this year. We used it. One of them was a selfie of the two of us that we had. That, I mean, we knew it was going to be big. It was, we knew it wasn't going to be like a snapshot size, but holy Moses, our faces are huge. But the quality is beautiful. It's a picture we both agreed on. And we gifted it to our parents for kind of a combined Father's Day, Mother's Day, once we got back. But the quality and the framing and the matting, oh my goodness, it was beautiful.
And the second one that we got done was, I got a picture of the Highland Coos that I just loved. And I actually, it was funny, the other night Lene came over and I don't have it hanging on the wall yet. And she walked in and she was like, oh my gosh, where did you get that? That's so cute. And I was like, I took that. And she was like, what? And then she goes, wait, is that your Framebridge picture you guys were always talking about? And I said, yes, it is. She goes, that? She's like, she could not get over how nice it was. So, aww. I mean, they do a fantastic job. So get started today. Frame your photos or send the perfect gift for weddings, birthdays, and special events. Go to framebridge.com and use promo code Outlander. You'll save an additional 15% off your first order.
Just go to framebridge.com, promo code Outlander. Framebridge.com, promo code Outlander.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing our Drums of Autumn read-along with Chapter 55, entitled Captivity, Part Deux, or I, or Two.
So Bree is like, what, 8 months now? 7 months now?
Sure.
As the chapter opens, Bree is painting, and we find out she's outdoors, so she's likely doing, you know, a landscape or something out in nature. And she refers to Jocasta along with Ulysses as the, quote, deadly duo. Now, while she does appreciate Jocasta coming, her company, and hearing all about her family and her life in Scotland and her grandmother, Ellen, and just hearing about the Fraser side of or the Mackenzie side of things, excuse me, Ulysses' presence annoys her. Apparently, he describes, quote, her every brushstroke out loud, unquote, leaving Ulysses to pick up her painting materials. She goes for a stroll with her aunt, there to have company, namely a Judge Alderdice from Cross Creek with his mother. Is this going to be more potential suitors? Jocasta is very social, and recently there have been a lot more single men among her guests. Later, when she's getting ready for, I believe it's the same night, Phèdre confirms, there aren't many single women in the colony.
I don't think I would have that many parties if I was blind.
Huh. Why? Because you couldn't see them?
Well, because you're just inviting all these people into your home. I don't know how well Jocasta knows all these people. And I'm just imagining she's not going to know if they steal things.
She won't. But she probably has a lot of slaves or a lot of... Yeah, I mean, I guess they're mostly slaves. People, a lot of eyeballs watching people as they eat.
Yeah, but if they're white people that are visiting and one of her slaves accuses them of stealing.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, who are they going to believe though?
Typically, probably not the slave.
Exactly.
But I'm just saying there's a lot of eyes, and having the eyes belong to a slave might lower the danger somewhat because it's not another white person who would accuse you. But still, you don't want to be seen doing stuff. I just think there's a lot of eyeballs there. But there's danger anywhere. But I don't, you know, blind or not, I just don't know if I'd want to. I guess, I don't know. If I were stuck at home and that was how I got most of my socializing in, then I might do more. I mean, I'm not Jocasta, but.
I imagine it's definitely safer for her.
Oh, heck yeah.
To stay home because she's measured the whole place. She knows from here to here how many steps it takes, where this lives. I can imagine going to somebody else's house being fraught with danger. How easily it would be to try to reach for something on the table and knock a candle over or
poison
trip
yourself
on a rug or misjudge a step that you can't see. So I imagine in that regard, it is definitely safer for her well-being to be at home. I just don't know if I'd open my house so freely to all these people.
Yeah, I think even if I had a big grand home and even if I were kind of housebound in a way, I still wouldn't have that many. I mean, I could imagine ratcheting it up for my niece if she needed, you know, someone to find a suitor. I mean, I can understand that. To me, that makes sense. Regardless of what our opinions are, our modern opinions are, or our contemporary opinions are, 21st century opinions, that makes sense to me. And I guess if you're rich, you entertain. I mean, I guess that's it. Well, Bree finds out also from Phèdre that she's Jocasta's heir. And apparently that wasn't quite ready for prime time just yet.
And she also had no choice. I was just like, but...
Ooh. Okay. Yeah.
You would think there would be a level of consent required. But I guess not. People will things to people all the time.
That's true. Well, exactly. And not just that. Well, yes, that. But also what Phèdre says, like, at three different times or in three different ways. It's really not about you, Bree.
Yeah.
It's basically all about Miss Jo.
Jocasta. Yeah.
Exactly. So apparently just after Jamie and Claire had dropped her off, within a week or so, Jocasta had had her lawyer change her will. Bree, of course, does not want this. Phèdre, as I already said, echoes a sentiment we've heard before. It's not about what she wants. It's about what Miss Jo wants. And she's inclined to get it. Ulysses' opinion is that Jamie had likely done the right thing by moving to the mountain. Because if he'd stayed, he'd have butted heads with his aunt all the livelong day. Because, yeah. Because we know that they were already doing it before he left. And later, Bree is looking at her sketch of Roger. Ulysses comes in to light the candles in the room for Jocasta to see by, and she notices his complete devotion to Jocasta's needs. We learn more about Ulysses. He's fluent in French and English, he understood math, and he could sing and play the harpsichord. Wow.
And he's fluent in being sneaky and telling tales on everybody around him.
Yeah.
Could you imagine, though, I mean, they try to be unobtrusive, but it's like, it's bad enough that she wants to know what she's painting. But could you imagine? It's one thing to watch, but it's another to have somebody go, and now she's taken a little bit of the titanium white and dabbed it into
That's Bob Ross gone wrong.
Chromium blue. Well, that's what I'm saying. But what if it was, he was, I'm just imagining narrating. Him describing it like a sports, exactly. like a sports commentator who's like narrating golf, only it's with paint.
Well, she blurts out and asks him, Ulysses, if he wants to be free. And she immediately regrets it. And he says, I was born free. We learned that his father had a small farm, but died when Ulysses was very young. And his mother had to sell herself into slavery to put him into a carpenter's apprenticeship. But when his mother died, the carpenter claimed him as a slave, for a slave, because he was the son of a slave woman, and thus he would be a slave. And he sold him. He was sold to a schoolmaster, and that is the man who named him. That was whom he learned from. He was 20 when the schoolmaster died. So Hector Cameron bought him. Hector taught him to play chess, to sing, to play the harpsichord, to provide entertainment to guests. And when Jocasta had begun to lose her sight, he gave him to her.
That was like a really messed up story.
It was very messed up. I mean, it's very sad. It's very sad. Like going from one place to the next I mean,
well, it's not awful. Only that. The larger thing for me was that, you know, he was born free.
Yeah.
To free parents. And his mom, who couldn't take care of them, sold herself back into slavery. And like under the conditions that her son be apprenticed. And then as soon as she dies, the guy who promised to apprentice him was like, never mind, he's a slave and I own him and I'm going to sell him for money now. And you know, it's his word against his, right? And nobody believes the black people over the white people.
Pisses me off.
Asked what his real name had been, he is not sure that he remembers.
Do you think he remembered and just didn't want to tell her because names are powerful and mean something?
I thought so. When I read through it to the end, I thought, you know what? I wonder if he just doesn't want to open that can of worms or just doesn't share it. But no, I don't think he remembered. And I'll tell you in just a second why, but I have to get to the chapter. Over. This is 55, right?
Yes.
He paused, thinking, then gave her a smile that did not reach his eyes. I'm not sure that I remember, he said politely, and went out.
It's the politely part and the smile that didn't reach his eyes that made me think he just didn't want to say it.
That's what I was thinking. But it could go either way.
And that's what I first thought. Yeah, well, exactly. Exactly. But I'm trying to figure out why, because that's what I initially
thought. It's Ulysses' secret to keep.
He paused, thinking. Yeah, I think because it was the politely. Yeah, I'm guessing he, well, okay, I know what it was. So the politely and the smile that didn't reach his eyes made me think that he did know and just wasn't going to say it. But I think two things, well, one thing made me think that he didn't remember. One was that he paused, but I don't think that means anything because the pause is just probably he's like shocked as heck. Like what you're asking me about me and not just about a fact like, oh, did you get the dinner done or whatever? You know, when's dinner going to be ready? You know, he's used to answering a lot of questions, but not about himself personally. But to me, the thing that might be evidence for him not remembering is the word thinking. For him to pause, okay, that could be just like surprise, right? He's like, wait, huh? And then he's thinking. It's the thinking part that makes, because you either know it or you don't. I don't think you have to think about it.
True, but he also didn't start telling her his story right away after she made the.
That's true. And he also could be thinking, should I say something or
right.
not?
He might be thinking, too far, white girl.
It could go either way.
And that was chapter 55. That was brief, y'all. That one flew by while listening to Davina. Now, 57, when we get to it, was not a flyby. That one took, and that must have taken, it felt like it took a majority of my drive today. And I was in the car for 3 hours. I don't know about you guys, but my favorite part of staying in a really nice hotel is the feeling of their fancy hotel sheets. Brooklinen was started by a husband and wife who didn't think it should be so difficult and expensive to get sheets like that at home. Brooklinen is the fastest growing bedding brand in the world with over 20,000 five-star reviews. They're based in Brooklyn and they're not your typical New Yorkers. They live in the city that never sleeps and yet they are committed to bringing you the best sleep ever.
Founded in April 2014 by husband and wife team Vicky and Rich Fullup and their dog Dukes. Their mission? To bring five-star hotel quality sheets to everyday life. Luxury sheets without the luxury markup. Most bedding is marked up as much as 300%. Brooklinen has a small business approach from being run by husband and wife to being involved in every step of the manufacturing process to a customer service team that cares so much they remember customers by name. And they have an old-fashioned spirit despite totally modernizing an old industry.
It's been how long now, Ginger? A year and a half?
Maybe. It was before I moved. So actually, before I moved to 2016. So it's been like 2 years.
2 years? 2 years I've been in love with these sheets, you guys. 2 years they still go with all of my accoutrement in my bedroom.
Really? These have been slept on and washed and, you know, and dried, and they are still so stinking soft.
My Brooklinen sheets are the best, most comfortable sheets I've ever slept on. Brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer for just our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code Outlander at Brooklinen.com.
Brooklinen is so sure you'll love your new sheets that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code Outlander at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com. Promo code Outlander.
Brooklinen. These are the best sheets ever. But we will move on to chapter 56, entitled Confessions of the Flesh.
We're back with Roger in Snake Town. Roger is still in the same, is he in a tent? Or I think he's in a longhouse still. I forget. Yeah, he's in a tent, I think. Whatever. He's somewhere. Roger wakes up and Fromage is gone. But no, he actually was there. He's sitting on his butt. He's sitting erect, I guess. And he says that they, meaning the Mohawk, they will kill him soon and very maybe that day. He asks Roger to hear his confession. And Roger's like, I don't swing that way, bud. He's like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that you're not a priest. Quote, in time of need, any man may do the office of a priest. Unquote.
He's like, and you're better than any man because your father was a pastor.
Roger agrees to hear it. This room or tent or longhouse, I think they're in a tent now. But anyway, this place where they're ran has become a holy place. Very cold, but a holy place in this moment. We learn more of Alexandre's story. He traveled to take the place of an older ill priest, and he was happy to be there. He was on a mission. He was a missionary, literally a missionary, to spread the good news and to convert souls for Christ. He met a war chief among the Mohawk who invited him to his village. And he says this was his first sin, the sin of pride. Now, he doesn't go further, but that makes me think is the sin of pride in that he thought he would be able to do all of this. Like, you know, yes, I can do it. Or maybe being too...
It's pride because no one had made any, like, progress converting any Mohawks. And he had not only a Mohawk, but a war chief who was like, come talk to my people. I really think you're onto something there, buddy. Let's go. You know, I'm the big
bad. And so he's like, I'm going to do this.
Right. He's like, oh, this is a sign. I am the one to do this. This is going to be all me. And I'm an amazing person.
So he goes with him and he learns the language and he preaches to them in their own tongue. His eventual converts actually included that very war chief. His second sin, he says, was falling in love with and being with a woman, so one of the Mohawk women. He ends up leaving the longhouse of the woman, but he realizes his sin. He realizes his error for him as a priest, right? And he decides to leave that situation. Not leave the tribe or not leave the village, but to leave the longhouse. But not before she becomes pregnant. Now, he says this is where the rub came in. This was the problem. He had always refused in his life as a priest and as a missionary. He had refused to baptize infants unless both parents were Christian. Therefore, he could not baptize this child. However, by refusing to do so, they took him to town. They tortured him. He was taken to a council to judge what to do with him. And he says, no, he wouldn't baptize his own child because the father himself was not in a state of grace. Then he stops and he says, there is no absolution for him. He doesn't have to, because to confess your sin and to receive absolution, you have to be truly penitent. And he is not sorry for loving the woman.
This chapter, man, it like does my head in trying to wrap my head around it, because I am not huge into organized religion. It's just not my thing. But to imagine that he's using that as a reason to not.
It's kind of selfish.
Yeah. To not baptize his own child. Or how about you just say, I love you. I'm going to give up the priesthood because I love you. And because I love you, you know, and I give up this one part of me that was making what we were doing a sin, then we can be together. It's not a sin anymore. And now we can find someone else to baptize. But you could take your baptizing robe off and just stop doing that and make that choice. But I guess maybe he's been a priest so long that that was not an option. I don't know.
Well, one of the things I don't understand, and you're right, there's a lot to unpack in this chapter, or at least a lot to think about. I don't know if that was Catholic practice in the 18th century. I really don't. From what I do understand in the 20th and 21st centuries, because you and I have friends where friends who are married, where one of the members, part of the couple is a Catholic and the other is not. And that doesn't mean, that has nothing to do with whether their children are baptized. Many times, if you are married in the Catholic Church and one person, obviously, typically one person is Catholic, otherwise, why be there? One of the agreements is that the children will be raised Catholic. Well, okay, that's kind of neither here nor there, but my point is, if he wouldn't baptize, I understand it's a different, baptism is different than a marriage, I get it. But, well, actually, no, excuse me, there is a point to it. So if the church, at least nowadays, will marry a couple, at least one member of which is Catholic and the other can be whatever, if they will marry a couple with the understanding that the children be raised Catholic, part of that system, part of that raising is baptism, right? So the church is already giving its authority, or using its authority, giving its blessing on this union and saying that, okay, so when you have children, they must be raised Catholic, or you agree to raise them Catholic. And part of that is baptizing them. So I don't know how much has changed, or if this was specific to Catholic missionaries going out to the indigenous. I have no idea. But I thought it was interesting that he would withhold baptism from a child, not in this instance, but in his past, like his practice. Why would he withhold baptism from a child because one of the parents was not Catholic? The only thing I could imagine is that the Catholic Church believes, if I'm not mistaken, that baptism is done, period, because of original sin, according to the church. But the baptism of infants is because it is part of, it's what welcomes them into the Christian family, right? And then it's part of the journey. Later on, when they're 6 or 7 or 8 or the age, they have to go through confirmation.
Isn't it also a safeguard because children didn't make it as often as they do and they wanted to give them a chance to get into heaven?
I believe so, yes. This obviously shows my lack of at least Catholic historical understanding. I have a little more knowledge because I've read a little bit about a number of religions that exist today, but not in their ancient or historical practice, just in kind of the practice of around the time that I'm living in. So yeah, if anyone knows this, I would find this, I'm very curious, has the Catholic Church's stance ever been to not baptize a child unless both parents are Catholic? Okay, that's my first question. The second question, and that's really a question for, I guess, anyone who knows. Now back to the story. Okay, agree, disagree, don't understand the reason behind it, whatever. We accept that that is his practice. What does not make sense is that I don't know if the woman he was with, obviously they weren't married, I don't know if the woman he was with was a Christian or not. I don't know if she was one of the baptized. I missed that, or I forget that if it was mentioned. But it's weird. If I didn't skip over something, it's weird because first he says he's not going to baptize the child because it doesn't have two parents that are Christian, because he's a Christian and I'm guessing the woman he lay with was not. And then he says, I can't baptize this child because I was not in a state of grace. Well, first of all, is he talking as a priest or is he talking as the father? Because I know for darn sure that the state of the soul of a priest does not affect whether his baptism of a child is valid or not. So baptism is a sacrament. Baptism, the Catholic Church, at least, I think most churches, believe that it is, you have to have certain things to make it valid. You have to have water, I believe, typically holy water, or at least water that's been prayed over. And you have to have the words. You know what I'm saying? You have to be, whether it's a dunk or whether you pour or whether you sprinkle, you have to have water and you have to have the words. So you have the form and the substance, that kind of thing. It doesn't matter the state of the priests or the missionaries or the preacher's soul. If it did, we'd have a lot of people that weren't getting baptized. The baptism comes from the things you see that you're using, as well as the, you know, spiritual side of things, the God part, if you will. So what do you think when he says that my soul, I'm not going to baptize this child because my soul, I'm not in a state of grace? Do you think he's saying that as a priest, or is he saying that as the father?
As the father, for sure.
You do think so? Yeah. Okay. So that was just a long right. for nothing.
Well, not only that, but it doesn't matter because they're still one and the same.
No, in the end, they have the same effect. Yeah. Oy vey. Leanne F. writes, this chapter starts out in a to kind of mimic what Summer said, starts out in a very bleak manner. Starts out, the whole thing is bleak, my dear.
I mean, he's clearly on death row. And now yes. we know that the reason that they want to kill him is because he won't baptize his own child, which seems, again, like a very strange reason to kill somebody.
So can things get any worse for poor Roger? Roger wakes up. This is Leanne again. Roger wakes up and is alone and cold without the priest near him. Overnight, the priest has made his peace with his destiny and is now past the need of human comfort. He knows he is going to die today. The priest is caught between his faith and human love. Much like Jamie earlier in the book, when he considers whether he would stand against God if given the chance to take revenge on Bonnet for what he did to Brianna, the priest chooses love over his faith. Roger and the priest have this in common. They are both captives of the Mohawk because of love of a woman. Roger had to follow Brianna into the past to protect her and to be with her. He went after the gems to try to provide a way for their return, for them to return to their own time. And when he arrived to make good on his promises to Brianna on Fraser's Ridge, he encountered her father instead, who mistakenly took him for the rapist, her rapist. As we have seen on many occasions, nothing good ever happens when Jamie and Claire are parted. And the same seems to be true for Brianna and Roger. Lesson learned. Roger should have followed Brianna to find her parents and not in pursuit of the gems.
That was chapter 56. We're going to finish off the evening, or the episode, I should say, with chapter 57 entitled A Shattered Smile. And this one, if you listened to Davina narrate it, went on for days.
So they've been in Snake... They, and by they, I mean JB and Claire, of course. They've been in Snake Town for about a week. Claire is mainly staying with the women, and thus far the Mohawk had been unwilling to admit that they had Roger. If the council approves their deal, they'll exchange the whiskey for him, the one whom they haven't formally admitted to having, in 3 days. Young Ian had proved a great spy and let Jamie know that they wanted the whiskey, the Mohawk did, but were wary of it and its effects on the people. And we learn Ian's found a girl who likes him.
But he can't be bothered to use her actual name. He's got to give her a white name.
Well, it is a little shorter.
It is shorter, but it seems pretty disrespectful.
The Council of Mothers aren't sure about the whiskey or giving up Roger. And it may be that the fact that more than one woman in the tribe fancies him means it's better for them to let him go than to have some infighting among their women. Just imagine, like, Roger's in that tent with Fromage trying not to think about dying. Meanwhile, all these women are like starting to at least inwardly fight about Roger. Oh my goodness. If he only knew. Jamie had even offered the opal to them. It didn't mean anything good to them, and they seemed to be afraid of it. He tells Claire that if there should be danger, to bring it out. It might save her, if it ever came to that. And he gives it back to her.
He's like, whip it out, Claire.
Oh, Lord. Jamie says that there's something going on in the village. He doesn't know what, but he can feel it.
They're
something
clearly
is happening.
Torturing a priest. Duh.
Huh. Ian meets them later and says that something is going on. And he's pretty sure it has to do with them somehow. He calls the lass he likes Emily. But her name, of course, the English translation of her Mohawk name is Works With Her Hands.
Right, which lends itself to Emily so easily.
It doesn't, but it's a lot longer.
It is. But again, I hear this all the time and I believe it. Names are important.
Yes, they are. But when he's just when he's addressing her, I'm sure he uses her Mohawk name.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're never in bed with them. So
I was that one time and he clearly called her Emily.
Emily is what he specifically does not use with her. She'd carved Ian a small otter. So she's good, as her name says, she is good with her hands. She's done some carving or whittling, I guess. And Ian genuinely likes her too. Ian says that he thinks the council would decide in their favor if they let him taste some of the whiskey. He asks if he can collect some so that they can have a Kaylee later that night. And he says, Emily will arrange it. It's Emily's aunt who is the pretty woman, the one who has it in her power to decide what's done with the captives.
Every time they said it, I said that, I kept expecting Roy Orbison to show up.
Did you think about the song?
Yes. Don't sing it.
I'm not going to.
Thank you.
That night, the Kaylee goes forward and a girl is pouring out the whiskey. Of course, Claire sees someone who needs a healing. A small boy's shoulder seems to be dislocated. She takes out the pièce en peur, the sapphire, from Naiwene's bag and gives it to the boy to hold on to. And then tells him, as you do, I'm a witch. The stone is medicine. Woman, I understand these people are maybe the people you could trust with that sentence. But using the W word with Claire is never a good idea, ever. Anyway, she receives permission from the boy's mother and she's able to relocate the dislocated arm rather quickly. The little boy gives the stone back to her. Claire is then summoned to the pretty woman's hearth. She asks to see her medicine, so Claire shares the pouch. And Claire confirms that she indeed is the wife of Bear Killer. And she gives them her Tuscaroran name, White Raven. Oops, that did not seem to make the best impression. She then shares the opal. The pretty woman had seen it before, or at least knew what it was. And she asked Claire through her interpreter, which I think was the granddaughter or great-granddaughter of the pretty woman. How did she get it? Claire answered that she got it in a dream. And then she tells her the dream. Of course, she was thinking, like, what do I tell her? These aren't dreams. This is not a dream. These are actually my memories. But to this woman, and of course she can't talk about her time travel and all of this. Anything or the way that she would express herself would be understood as a dream. So she could talk about whatever she wanted and no one would get after her for being a weirdo because this is a dream. And they were astonished that she'd seen the fire carrier. Of course, that's Ottertooth. She describes what he'd looked like. Then the pretty woman shares her own story. Some 20 years earlier, a man had come to them with strange speech. He was wild, but brave. He was a good hunter and warrior, and he always talked of war. He said they needed to go to war against. Now, this is my translation, not anyone else's, but I'm just... She did mention, Diana did write the word white or whites in there, but the word she used was in italics. She used the word white, the English word white, but she also used another word that the pretty woman uses. Oh, I don't even know. I'll butcher it. But it was italicized and it started with an O. Anyway, so I'm just going to use white man. So this man, the stranger, said that they needed to go to war against the white man before it was too late. And this, of course, was Ottertooth. He saw far enough, he said, into the future. Then one day, Ottertooth danced the war dance, painted. After a council was called, Ottertooth was told he must leave the village. He kept talking. He would leave and come back and leave and return again and again and again. During these cycles, he did actually get people to go with him, and they returned with scalps. So they were doing raids or mini wars, I guess you could say. And he was like, well, look, we need to keep doing this. We need to keep doing this. And then he was finally told, look, you have to leave or you will be killed. He was a stranger and he didn't understand that he was one. Claire now has the confirmation that she needed that Ottertooth was a traveler. He was a stranger. He had strange speech. Of course he didn't understand. He couldn't believe they'd meant to do him harm. But of course they meant it. In the end, they'd stripped him, tied him to a pole, and painted his face with black ink. They tortured him. Left him there. In the morning, he was gone. They followed him to make sure he didn't come back. He faced them, knowing he had no way out. And he talked, and he kept talking, even after he was bashed in the mouth with the war club. After his death, his words continued to haunt them. They got the idea. They'd already returned to the village by now. They got the idea to cut off his head and then he wouldn't talk anymore. So they go back out to the body and did so. And they tied it to the branches of a spruce tree. But it still didn't work. It still haunted them. Then a brave man said that he'd take the head far away and bury it. And since then, they'd heard nothing. And of course, as they describe where this man had buried it, we recognize the place where Claire had been. But it worked.
She didn't find all that other stuff, though.
No, she just got the skull.
Because he said it was wrapped in, like, leather. And
yeah.
So probably some, like, woodland creatures stole the leather. And
well, it was 20 years, so it could have eroded.
That's also true.
I didn't think about that either. But yeah, it's been a hot second. And since then, they'd heard nothing. And Ottertooth's name hadn't been spoken since until now. Then what about the opal? Well, it had been his. He had called it Tikaba. Claire lies when she says she doesn't know.
I don't know why she keeps trying to lie. It has been made very clear since book one that she is incapable of believably lying.
She's lying when she says she doesn't know why she was given the opal. But she could hardly tell the truth. She says instead maybe he was part of her family. The pretty woman nods and agrees that Ottertooth had sent her to him to hear his story, that two of them can witness his life and he is not forgotten. When she leaves the hearth, Jamie and Ian are nowhere to be found. She goes outside and they're waiting for her there. He says that the Kaylee likely worked and he thinks that they'll be able to make a bargain. She says she would tell Jamie all about her conversation with the pretty woman once they got inside to where they were going. Claire had known what the opal was to Ottertooth. His Tikaba had been his unused ticket back. It was her legacy. I've read this book I don't know how many times, and when I got to the end of that, I still got chills.
I think she was incredibly intuitive to have put that together so quickly.
Right?
Because if somebody was just like, Tikaba, that's like watching Nell for the first time and her saying, Tay and away.
Yeah.
Tay and away. And not, you know, it's like, what? And it took you a whole almost most of the movie before they were like, oh, she's saying tree in the wind. Okay. But you needed a real translator for it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for her to instantaneously have been able to translate that. I mean, there were context clues.
Yeah.
However, still.
Eileen P. writes, regarding the chapter title, A Shattered Smile, it suggests someone being happy, and then that happiness is suddenly crushed. I'm hoping it's not violently crushed and reminds me of Roger reaching Fraser's Ridge to be with Brianna, only to be beaten to a pulp by Jamie and young Ian. A shattered smile indeed. Later, when Jamie is negotiating with the Mohawk to trade whiskey for Roger, I think Roger will find that trading whiskey for him is a high compliment. It's better than gold. I hope the negotiations succeed, but hope Jamie, Claire, young Ian, and Roger are well on their way out of the village before the Mohawks sample the whiskey. Hopefully they'll be so drunk that they will meet the Jamie Fraser definition of drunkenness. They canna stand.
Right? But it was only one cask. How many casks did they bury?
Oh, they got, I don't know, but it was their entire year's supply. It was their entire year's, not supply, their share, their entire year's share of the whiskey that had been well for the whole year.
Go big or go home.
Eileen says regarding Ian being a spy, remember when we first meet Fergus as a child pickpocket? Does Jamie take him in to take him away from a life of crime? No, he employs the child as a pickpocket. Now we have Jamie admiring and encouraging wee Ian's spying abilities. What would Jenny say?
Well, I don't know that he has the same agreement that he gave Fergus.
Oh, no. Jamie's like,
which was, you know,
I'll do that once and I learned my lesson. I'm not doing that again.
Exactly. He's like, you're family already. That's going to have to be good enough. You know better. And if you do anyway, you're taking your own risks.
Now, Eileen thinks it was a nice little twist having the women objectify Roger. Oh, he's cute. Can we keep him? For Roger, this might be helpful. Emily's aunt would rather not have the conflict among the women, though, as they fight over possession of Roger. Catfight.
Well, think about it. It's like he shows up and he's just this super hairy guy. And they're like, wow, I've never had a hairy guy. None of our men even can grow facial hair or like arm hair. I bet they have hair in the...
They have follicles.
In the naughty places.
I've never asked anyone, Summer. That's not my business.
I mean, I imagine all humans do. They all naturally have hair in the regions, but they don't all have hairy chests or hairy legs or hairy whatevers. And so if you just see somebody who shows up and he's just so very different, you're like, well, hello. That's new.
Regarding Emily measuring the whiskey, Eileen says, I was surprised that Emily measured the whiskey by the mouthful. And then I found this. And she shares some links, which we'll put in the show notes. Quote, interestingly, it may be that all English unit-derived capacity measurements are derived
from Emily's mouth.
Original approximate measurement, the mouthful, consisting of about a half ounce, called the roe in ancient Egypt, their smallest recognized unit of capacity. The mouthful was still a unit of liquid measure during Elizabethan times. Wow. And then she writes, let's see. Emily measures 3 mouthfuls at a half ounce for each cup of whiskey. That's a total of 1.5 ounces per serving. Now, a dram is 1/8 of an ounce. And then she says, how many drams did each Mohawk drink? We have no clue, my darling. And she shares 2 links. We'll put those in the show notes, as I said. And finally, regarding using time travel to change the course of history. Eileen writes, it's interesting that Claire, Galus, and Ottertooth all try to change history as time travelers. Both Galus and Ottertooth promote rebellion to save their people. On the other hand, Claire tries to prevent rebellion. Despite all their efforts, none of them succeeded in changing history. Notice with Galus and Ottertooth, the violence promoters, they were both decapitated in the end. That's true.
I would like people to go out this weekend and try to order Emily's mouthful portion of their favorite spirit.
Better yet, get with friends and try to give your friends Emily's mouthful.
What are you drinking there? 3 Emily's mouthfuls of whiskey.
Let me show you.
Oh my God.
Oh my goodness.
And that was chapter 57. Join us next week when we will be discussing three more chapters, starting with chapter 58, entitled Lord John Returns. Grande, y'all.
Uh-oh. Speaking of grande, I've seen some of those t-shirts you guys have shared with us online. We love seeing them. Oh my goodness, they're so cute.
And for those interested, there are still 49 more states in the United States that you could also have a grande license plate from.
Oh, that's right. Summer shared in our group. She got her California license plate. Now you all know how to look her up.
Say hi. I like it when people say hi.
Thank you guys so much for coming along on this journey. And if you love our show and would like to continue to hear more of it, we hope, there are a number of ways you can help support us. Of course, always, 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 if you support our sponsors, that really helps out because our sponsors help support us. And so it's kind of a nice big, almost like a love triangle, but no, it's not a love triangle. It's just the more you support them, the more they'll want to support our show, which makes our show possible for us. And of course, there are many free ways to support our show. Retweeting our show tweets, regramming or reposting our Instagram posts for the show, or sharing our Facebook posts for the new episodes. Anyway, and of course, telling your friends and family who love Outlander about the Outlander podcast.
And if you want to join us on our Facebook page to continue the conversation, you can find us at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20. Outlander20 for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.